We are in the Bonneville Room, Section 3. If that's not the room you're supposed to be in, then you can leave now and we won't stare at you. The subject of our session today is On Beyond Zion, Developing a Church-Compatible Model for Life. Our first speaker will be Jeff Burton, author of For Those Who Wonder and a consulting engineer living in the Salt Lake City area. He will speak for 30 minutes, after which he will be responded to by Richard Paul, author of What the Church Means to People Like Me and Liahona and Iron Rod Revisited. That will last for 15 minutes, after which time the audience will be allowed to ask any questions to the presenters they like. That's it. Jeff Burton.
Thank you. Let's see if I can get this to get in my mouth. It's good to be with you and good to see Dick Paul again. It's been about 9 years since I presented a... That's okay. It'll be all right. If necessary, I'll pull it out. It's been about 9 years since I presented a paper, The Phenomenon of the Closet Doubter, and I was kind of curious if there would be anybody in the audience who was actually at that presentation. Was anybody there? A few, interesting. Seems like there's been some turnover, but today I'm going to present a paper, and it's quite long, and I may not be able to give the whole thing, so I've got copies of it. My friend Marlene Pugh, if you could give some to each of the row, we'll pass them down, and... You're not going to remember what I say, and maybe you wouldn't want to, but if you do want to, we have this paper for you to read. It's kind of small. You may have to get your magnifying glass. In addition to that, I've got some overheads that I'll use as we go through this material. So give me a second to get that first overhead on, and we'll... One thing, I'm going to tell you a few things about myself as we go through. One thing that you might be interested in knowing is that since 1982, I was involved with the LDS Social Services for 5 or 6 years and had a chance to meet with and talk with a number of people, troubled people and questioning people and so forth. And so I've had a chance, because of the book, For Those Who Wonder and all of this, to speak with and to hear from and read letters of many, many people who have had questions about their testimonies about faith and so forth. And somehow I seem to have gotten myself involved in this area. So when people run into where they have a question about the basic tenets of our religion, they seem to have some choices. They can either regain those beliefs, you know, by fasting and prayer and so forth, or they can keep quiet, like the closet doubter kind of thing. Some try to convince others that they're right, and of course they usually fail. Many leave activity in the church, and many leave the church, period. And some stay and adopt to the situation they find themselves in. And that's what I think is useful and possible, and what I usually suggest to people when they come and talk to me about it. And if of course, you can't reestablish your original beliefs and your faith about the whole thing. But in order for this approach to work, we have to have a continued relationship with God, and you have to adopt a lifestyle and a personal religion which is compatible with Mormon expectations and also, of course, compatible with Christ's teachings and the kind of behavior that you would expect as a Christian. The other aspect of this, besides stay, I usually recommend to people if they can to stay and to try to adopt. The other thing that I'm suggesting to people is to be completely honest about your situation, both with yourself and with others. That doesn't mean that you rush home and divulge all to unsuspecting children, spouses, parents, friends, bishops, and things like that. But what it means is that you prepare yourself to be tactfully honest without hurting other people about what your real situation is. The reason for doing that is because people who cannot have their behavior follow their true beliefs, their emotional lives suffer, and of course then people around them suffer. Now, in addition to that, if you decided, for example, I'm going to try to stay and adopt, then, of course, new motivators have to be found, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of that aspect. Coming down on the last, next to the last, I was last November, I was asked to speak at a meeting of Society of St. Chad. This is an Episcopal Church sponsored support group for Mormons who are experiencing a crisis of their faith. I went there hoping to persuade some of them to reconsider some of their thinking about it. Unfortunately, I wasn't too successful. But I did, it was sort of an interesting meeting. There were a whole lot of people there, and they had sort of like a testimony meeting. And if you've been there to it, each person stands and gives their experience. Most had lost their belief and faith in Mormonism, and it was obviously a very wrenching and emotional experience for most of them, and there was a lot of anger and resentment expressed, a lot of hostility. But there were a few people who also seemed to register an acceptance and a recognition of what the situation they were in, and they were kindly, they thought kindly toward the church, and they hadn't left the church. I presented my ideas to this group, and it's kind of the thing I'm going to present to you today, and that's one thing is the first, right on the bottom of the handout, I hope you can see that. It really doesn't matter if you can't, but just trying to give you something to look at besides myself. It is possible to stay active in the church, even when we are troubled by doubts and questions. It really is. It's possible, Marlene, if I could have that next slide, it's possible also to have divergent opinions about the church and divergent lifestyles and still be compatible and not be alienated from the church or from other Mormons. And the third thing is that it's possible to have a relationship with God regardless of your feelings about the church or some aspect of it. And you can still have a personal religion which is ethically based and very good and compatible with the Mormon church and compatible with other Mormons. And the fourth thing is that there is a difference between, you know, our Mormonism and the church itself. The church administers our daily, you know, the daily affairs of the church, of course, but I'm going to have to read part of this because it's just going to be faster. But Mormonism is also the tradition, the culture, the ethical base, the history, and the society of a people. It's a way of life for many of us. It's often the center of our emotional lives and maybe deeply engraved on our psyche. It's the primary connection to Christ and God for some. It's the vehicle for delivering and interpreting Christ's teachings. Leaving the church may be possible, but leaving behind our Mormonism may not be possible. And the question that I would have for those of you who are considering that, and unfortunately many people do, and that is the question is, why not consider trying to stay with the church as well? Why not try trying to be compatible with the church rather than try to fight against it? Now, when there's a certain, we can think of our church activity as sort of like a model house, a special house. The foundation, while strong and standing on bedrock, is somewhat hidden in the ground. It's Christ's life and teachings, you know, the honesty and morality and prayer and loving, giving and sharing and faith and all those things that Christ taught us. And the visible structure above that is the church. It's lit, well lit and clean and shiny, and it's nicely furnished with freshly painted and walls and squeegeed windows and vacuum rugs and nice solid appliances and tidy plants and wax floors and all that. It has food on the table, soft music on the stereo, and plenty of instructions for operating all the appliances and equipment. Everything is in order, and the radio and television provide constant direction for the occupants' lives. This above structure, of course, represents the church and its furnishings and floor plan, the unique Mormon beliefs, lifestyles, activities, and church organizations. Now, what some of us would like to believe or not to believe is true, and that is that life in the house is very successful and very satisfying and very happy for most of the people who are there. We'll talk about some statistics in a minute. There's plenty to do, and for those who accept and believe it as a satisfying existence, the house comes with detailed instructions for most aspects of life and with specific guidelines for developing relationships with God and other people. And of course, the church encourages us to develop a personal relationship with God, and it also encourages us to develop a personal religion. What it does do also is it gives us a distinct blueprint and a way of doing these things, which we are expected to adhere to fairly closely. We have some leeway, but not too much. Let's see, where are we? Down about halfway, living in the church house. Generally, occupants of the church house are required to keep the house neat and clean. They do not have permission to change things a lot. The landlord insists that occupants maintain the house and pay regular rent by attending meetings, supporting church activities, doing temple work, paying tithing and offerings, and preparing and teaching lessons, among other tasks. The problem is that for some of us, there is a problem with some of the aspects of the house. Some of us don't like to be eating the same kind of food that everybody else is eating. We don't like the same instructions. We don't like doing the things the same way that everyone else does them. And this is where problems arise, of course. After my paper on the phenomenon of the closet doubter, the church conducted a study of faith and among Mormons in the United States, and the Church Correlation Department, through this study, found that about 60-70% of active Mormons are very happy, unruffled, completely satisfied with things as they are. But on the other hand, that means that 30-40% of Mormons are somewhat have some level of discomfort and some disagreement, some doubts, in fact, about what's going on. And it's my own personal view, and I'm not sure, even this study kind of suggested it, that about 5-10% of active Mormons actually don't really believe it. They don't even give it any question of benefit of the doubt. They just stay because of all the reasons that we know why people stay. A recent study conducted by BYU also showed that for every 10 Mormon converts, we have simultaneously 3 people leaving the church. And they tried to determine what the reasons were for these people leaving the church. And a significant number of them left because of questions and doubt about the church. So there's some statistics to think about. That very bottom item on the overhead, outcomes of skepticism. Lots of things happen. Every person is different. We can't necessarily generalize. But I've kind of seen 6 kind of ways people respond to this. And one is that we make do. That's probably what most of us do to begin with. And I've got some examples of people's lives. If you'll bear with me, I'm going to read some of these. If you can find it on the handout, it's under We Make Do. Frederick, a convert in his mid-20s, joined the church while studying on the East Coast of the United States. He accepted it without reservation. Moving to the West Coast, he married another female convert, and they had become quite active in the church. His first temple experience, when he and his wife were endowed and sealed about a year after his marriage, had been negative, starting wondering about other aspects of the church. One afternoon while a business trip, he realized that he didn't really believe the central tenets of the church anymore. For several years, he endured the tensions of doubt in relative silence. Even his wife did not know the depths of his dissatisfaction. His emotional life suffered because his behavior did not follow his true beliefs. Eventually, we met and discussed his options. After several meetings, he brought his wife with him and disclosed all to her in a rush of tears. She was very supportive, but confused and troubled, as you can imagine. Later, he made known to his ward his questioning and continued some activity in the church, but without enthusiasm. And here's the key part of it. He has yet to find complete peace with himself or to choose a definite approach to his life. His personal relationship with God is also ill-defined and unsteady. If we become like Frederick, we try to ignore our doubts and disagreements and struggle along trying to live in the Mormon house, attempting to fit in as best we can. Sometimes we do it without telling anyone about our true beliefs and feelings. Sometimes we feel a lot of anger and resentment, which results in explosions, anger, and hurting ourselves and others. Our relationships with God are strained, and we are confused about which behaviors and attitudes are correct. Now, obviously, these people, the names are not real and so forth, and I changed some of the details so that to protect privacy. But these are real experiences and real people that we have met. The second kind of thing people try to do, they try to find a new home. number two there. Bob had studied Mormonism with a fervor not seen in most Mormons. He knew scripture, history, and doctrine like few others. The motivation for his strong attention to religion was driven first by a need to prove Mormonism correct, and later by the opposite need. When I first spoke with him, he was spending 3 to 4 hours per day studying, thinking, writing letters to general authorities, and so forth. He was consumed by the problem and had little relief from the tensions he felt. Rebuffed in his efforts to have people see things his way, he left the church and eventually joined a sort of one of those New Age groups in Oregon. Unfortunately, he also left his family. But if we're like Bob, what we do is we leave the Mormon house and move to another house. The new house provides another model, and we adopt the ways of our new house and housemates. Sometimes we may drive by the old house, but can't go back. We often develop a new personal relationship to God, or we have no relationship at all, and we have a new personal religion. Now, I'm sure this works for many people, but it's not the way that I prefer to go, and it's not the way I think you should try first. I think you might have some negative results from this. The third kind of thing is people, we can't find a home. And there's a little story there, and Susan grew up in the church but became disaffected during college. At 35, she had not yet married and was totally inactive. She dabbled in various other religious systems but never adopted any particular tenets, belief, or prescriptive behaviors for herself. She had no personal relationship with God. She seemed like an educated drifter. Her life was constantly changing, and many sad and unfortunate experiences left her cold and hardened. She is still angry and bitter with the church, which she believes has ruined her life by misleading her. If we're like Susan, we abandon the house, our Mormon house, and move from apartment to apartment, never really settling down again. We reject the Mormon model and don't accept any others. Our lives follow a winding road, taking us from place to place. There's some adventure in this trip, but we make many mistakes, sometimes learning from our experiences, sometimes not. We indulge ourselves in activities that end up in pain for us and others. Our lack of purposefulness means that we never really find happiness or satisfaction. We blame others for our problems and our unhappiness, like our parents. We have, at best, a limited relationship with God or Christ, and we have no distinct model for our lives. The fourth thing people try to do is try to change the occupants of the house. And this is kind of a sad situation, but Roger, this fellow that I'm calling Roger, was a champion of kind of critical and logical thinking, which, of course, is good, but you've got within reason. They became the source and support of his own doubts about the historical claims of the church. He stayed active in the church, but tried to help others be critical thinkers, too. His own children, 3 boys and 3 girls, were taught the importance of reason, logic, and critically evaluating all claims. As a result, several of his older children have gone on to study science and engineering, but only 2 of 6 remain active in the church. 2 of the inactive children, instead of reacting only to the irrational and contradictory parts of Mormonism, have rejected Christ's teachings entirely and are ethical wanderers. These negative outcomes have proven to be a heavy burden for Roger, who naively assumed that his family would hold strong to Christ's principles of living. Well, if we're like Roger, we kick against authority and try to force change on others. We try to convince others that our way is right, and rarely do we succeed. Number 5, we reaccept the house as it is, and there's a story there which I won't read to you because we've all known people who have had crisis of their faith, and through prayer, fasting, and other things have been able to reestablish their testimonies. This is, of course, the approach the church would like us to take, and I would agree. I mean, if you can get back to that unruffled state and never have to worry about it again, who would complain about that? And then the 6th one is what I call we redecorate our house. This is a staying adopting. And there's a woman that I know that called Terry. She's been a Mormon for all of her life. She married in the temple, lived the life of a typical Mormon. In her mid-30s, she experienced a long crisis of her faith, which began when one of her children contracted cancer. Acknowledging that it would be impossible for her to reestablish the correct beliefs, she worked out an agreement with her husband, still an active true believer, which allows both them to pursue their respective religious lives with as little conflict and disruption as possible. Terry's personal relationship with God is intense and meaningful, and she relies heavily on prayer. Her activities with Mormons, though limited, are mature, loving, and mutually accepting. Her marriage and family appear strong and healthy. Her life is directed by a personally created model based on Christ's teachings. So if we're like Terry, we stay in the Mormon house, but we rearrange the furniture the way we like it. There are some problems, of course, with this. If I could have that next slide. There are certain risks to changing it, aren't there? Our friends, housemates, and neighbors may dislike the changes, the disruption, and our rearrangement of the standard model. It's going to be threatening to people. Family members may follow our lead, but to excess and with emotional disruption. Our leaders may disapprove and may distance themselves from us. Additionally, this personalized approach can cause real problems if the changes we make are dangerous and ill-advised. The house may cave in around us, or we may be asked out if our changes are too radical. So we take a chance in redecorating, but we accept the risk because it makes living in the house acceptable and tolerable. This last approach, this sixth approach, the staying adopting, is the one that I suggest as a possibility for you if you are considering leaving the church. Obviously, you have to make up your own choice, your own mind about how you're going to respond to these things, but I think it can work. And why it can work? Well, there are four reasons I give in this paper. One, you can have a personal relationship with God. You don't necessarily need to have a firm, unbending testimony to have that. The blessings of the gospel, number second one, the blessings of the gospel come through following Christ's teachings and through appropriate behaviors. It doesn't require a belief in Joseph Smith to be honest with other people, for example, and you're going to reap the benefits of being honest. The next one, the particular beliefs about Mormonism may vary within certain bounds. We all know that we don't have a creed in the Mormon Church, which is fortunate. We do have some latitude. And it's not required to have an unwavering belief in the divine origin of the Book of Mormon to attend church, for example. You can still do it. It might make it a little uncomfortable, but you can do it. And finally, it's possible to be open and honest about our beliefs and feelings with each other. And this is important, and eventually I urge all people struggling with this problem to do this. And let me digress for just a moment and tell you a little bit about myself. I've been kind of a questioner all my life. I remember my mother, we went to a ward on the near 27th South and 13th East. I remember her pointing out a mural up on the front of the chapel which depicted Joseph Smith being visited by God and Jesus. And I innocently kind of put that fantastic story into the same realm and category of other fantastic stories that my mother had been reading to me as a child. But so from an early age, I was a little bit, I guess it must be genetic or something. But anyway, as time went by and as I grew, of course, I wanted to be a participating Mormon. I wanted to believe. I wanted to accept, and I did primarily. But in graduate school, I had some free time, and so I sat down and got a copy of the documentary History of the Church. And of course, in those days, we didn't realize it wasn't quite authentic. But anyway, I read all those volumes. And in reading it, I was a little bit troubled, and it set my mind to wondering about the Joseph Smith story and, you know, how truthful it was and so forth, and started me thinking about the claims and so forth. Eventually, I came to realize that I was not going to have a firm, unwavering testimony of the gospel. But on the other hand, I sort of see it as a blessing because, in a way, I get sort of a high of being curious and wondering about things and doubting things and looking into things. Although that's even passed away, and now I'm more at peace with kind of the idea that, you know, this is what God has intended for me. It's not going to change, and it really doesn't matter. I'm happy the way I am. I've tried to maintain my relationships in the church. I've changed a little bit of the focus of it, and instead of taking these leadership positions as high councilman and so forth, I sort of drifted over and started working with LDS Social Services, which has been a great blessing for me. But the reason I tell you this is not because I want to, impress you or anything, but I want you to see that it is possible for us to be honest with each other, and I think this is the key to opening up and being more at peace with ourselves, is to tell other people about it. And not necessarily, I don't want anybody standing up here and telling, but, you tell your spouse, tell your bishop, tell your friends, tell your parents, and so forth, how you're feeling, and I think it'll be a lot more emotionally healthy and make it easier for you to move on and stay with the church too. Now, how much time?
5 minutes.
Okay. One thing is, if a little bit of a warning, if you decide to stay and adopt, if you decide to change and adopt a personal religion for yourself, you have to be careful. Be sure that you take your family's need into consideration. Be sure you think this thing through. And I've got some, you know, write down a sample model for yourself. What does a personal religious model look like, and how can it be compatible with Mormonism? Well, I've got one that I kind of like written out there, and I'm not going to tell you, but could you put that next slide on? It's got to fit your own needs, and it's got to be compatible with what your life is like. And I kind of broke my own model down into five categories. The things that I kind of want to do as it pertains to Christ up there at the top, the things that I want to do pertaining to God, the things I want to do pertaining to other people, the things I want to do pertaining to the church, and pertaining to my own life. And I'll just read a couple of them. As it pertains to God, to Christ, for example, you can see I wrote down that as goals, and we have to, of course, make this as, these are idealistic goals, and of course you don't want to, you don't want to feel too much guilt if you can't follow them. But one, I study Christ's life and teachings as a goal for myself. I try to follow Christ's example, for example. As it pertains to God, for example, I wrote down, I try to understand God and my relationship with God. As it pertains to other people, I've written down, I listen. I try to understand others. I accept others and their personal religion without criticism. I allow others to have their own beliefs, feelings, and desires. I try not to convert others in the church to my way of believing. I hope you won't get the idea that's what I'm doing here, but I'm suggesting a way for you to stay in the church, because I know some of you will drift away. I think it's a sad thing. As it pertains to the church, I've written down, I am honest about my beliefs and feelings about the church, but I am not critical of it or its leaders. I remain active as it benefits me and others. I accept callings which are compatible with my abilities and desires. I take responsibility for my activity in the church. So forth. As it pertains to my personal life, I accept things as they are. When I have problems, I try to solve them. When I make mistakes, I say I'm sorry. You can see it's kind of a thing that if you write it down, you can get a kind of a sense as to where you really are, and then you begin to take responsibility for yourself. If you're going to move away from the church's model, which says do it this way, then you have to take responsibility for it. But you won't even know what you feel until you actually sit down and try to write it out. Now, living the model is kind of the next step, and it's kind of difficult. As I mentioned up there, this next step may be difficult. The thing to do is to make sure that it's realistic. Don't try to set goals in a model for yourself that you can't live. And the last thing in the paper deals with motivation, and my time is up in one more minute. But let me just mention a couple of things. We have, those of us who have grown up in the church particularly, we have motivators which motivate us to do things. There's the presenting motivators, you know, the ones we like to hear, like love of God, love of church, and so forth. And the hidden motivators are there too. They're the group pressure and the guilt and the fear and the potential for divine punishment. These latter motivators, while strong, are often obscured and rarely mentioned, perhaps accepted perhaps as a denial of their existence. When used, they have a positive sounding tone. For example, you hear people say, I couldn't afford not to pay tithing. Well, that's just a positive and non-threatening way to say, if you don't pay tithing, God will not only not provide for you, but he will also take away that which you have. And so we have to identify what these motivators are. And if you're going to be happy in your new life, in your new model, you have to identify what those motivators are and try to make them take away the ones that are difficult ones, the ones that are grounded in guilt and fear. And I'm going to let you read the rest of this. I think there are three stories here about some people who had unwarranted fear and guilt. And it's something that those of us who have grown up in the church, we have it whether we like it or not, and we need to identify it. And we worked countless hours with people trying to help them to see that their life needn't be. I'm sorry my time is up, but maybe we'll have some time for some questions afterward. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Burton. We will now hear comments from Richard Paul.
Phil has made one or two modifications in the paper since I received a copy, and he has omitted one or two things to which are relevant to what I shall have to say, but we all do that, and I shall make such adaptations as may be necessary in order to so I seem to be commenting on what he has said. This is an interesting and worthwhile paper by a man who has influenced the thinking and the lives of many Latter-day Saints. I have found a few things to cavil, quibble, and ruminate about, and I appreciate being invited to do so. It is possible, Brother Burton told the Society of St. Chad, to stay active in the church even when troubled by doubts and questions. This, it seems to me, is the Liahona position. After trying for years to find any active Latter-day Saint who admitted being without any doubts or questions, I have decided that iron rod Mormons are people who are not seriously troubled by them. One of the strengths of Mormonism is that it does not require us to confront our doubts or questions, but helps us to avoid or transcend them through engrossing activities and generalized affirmations of faith. Jeff added, quote, it is possible as a Mormon to have divergent opinions and lifestyles without becoming alienated from the church or other Mormons. Not only is it possible, but this statement is descriptive of almost all active Latter-day Saints, both Liahona and Iron Rod. One has only to observe the range of opinions and lifestyles on Sabbath observance, women working, temple going, PG-13 movies, testimony bearing, community service, abortion, scripture reading, voting in politics, meeting attendance, and home teaching, to recognize that every Latter-day Saint defines Mormonism in his or her own terms. While the landlord in Jeff's church house metaphor may not encourage the tenants to change things very much, in fact, they do, sometimes with feelings of guilt and sometimes without. Tenants are free to move out for any reason, but very few forms of deviant behavior guarantee eviction. Most of them involve sexual sins or shouting at the landlord. I take mild exception to Jeff's interpretation of defections from Mormonism. Quote, reasons for leaving vary, he says, but a significant percentage are related to loss of belief. As to convert turnover, which I understand to be higher than that among people born in the church, loss of belief is secondary, sometimes inconsequential, if belief be defined in propositional terms. Most converts come from unsettled personal or community backgrounds, knowing little about the church at the time of baptism. They join because they think becoming Mormons will make them happier. They leave or lapse into inactivity when they find out that they are not happier. Why? Because for them, the church turned out to be different from what they expected. Or because their former environment exerts too strong an appeal. Or because the requirements for being happy in the Mormon community overtax their resolve to repent and reorder their lives. Crisis of belief is more prevalent among people like Jeff and me who have been in the church house for a long time. But even here, as Jeff's paper argues, loss of belief need not precipitate withdrawal from the church. For many Latter-day Saints, the faith that is lost is a simplistic abstraction. The gospel is true, or the church is true. Knowledge and experience may call into question some of the propositions conventionally associated with such testimonies, and Jeff has listed several of them. But the discomfort from such a piecemeal loss of faith may not outweigh the continuing rewards of membership, particularly if they stem more from doing Mormonism than from thinking about it. After all, aren't most of the Fast Sunday testimonies from us old-line Latter-day Saints simply personalized affirmations that being Mormons makes us happy? Which, according to 2 Nephi 2 and 25, is what the gospel is all about. Men and women are, that they might have joy. There are many reasons why living in the House of Mormonism may stop bringing happiness. Boredom and unjust treatment are examples. The incessant admonitions to obey and conform relate only marginally to loss of belief, because their target is not beliefs, but attitudes and actions. Neither closet doubters, passive aggressors, nor iron rod 50%ers are subject to particular sanctions, provided that they do not manifest ill will or flaunt institutional taboos. I suspect that many who leave the church, including young people who drift away in the post-primary years, do so because being Mormon has, for them, just ceased to be fun. Jeff's paper, however, focuses on those members who live in such a house of faith that cracks in the walls threaten to bring down the whole edifice. There is a thread in Mormon teaching that encourages the building of such houses. As a child, I remember hearing an apostle say that Joseph Smith was either the greatest prophet or the greatest fraud that ever lived. I still hear testimonies to the inerrancy of the scriptures, the infallibility of the prophets, and the power of prayer to command gods and angels. And a house of faith built upon such propositions is vulnerable to new knowledge, to injustice, or to personal tragedy. Now, here I should point out that when in Jeff's original version of the paper, he had Roger, one of his sample accommodators, remodeling the house. Now he has substituted the word redecorating the house, which to me suggests far more cosmetic than substantial change. But I, in any case, having already noted the prevalence of redecorating Mormonism without either blueprint or permit, which goes on in the church, I offer this advice to the Terrys who plan to make a project out of it following Jeff's thoughtful suggestions. And there, that approach is all in the part of the paper which you, most of you have in your hands, which I commend to you to read, but which is only that he has only had opportunity to introduce to you. But essentially it amounted to seeing what you can handle and what you can't handle, letting the people who are important to you know what kind of an adjustment you're working out, and then trying to achieve peace of mind through that, being honest with yourself and those who are important to you. I have only these three suggestions to make with regard to a proposal which could be explored in much greater detail. One, a simple systematic sorting out of doubts and questions is unlikely to produce lasting peace of mind, but it may help you to decide that the church is still your house, that you still find joy in being Mormon. Two, sharing your remodeling plans outside the circle of trusted family and friends is as likely to disrupt as to promote spiritual equilibrium. Of course, your trusted circle may include church leaders. Three, this seems to me pretty pivotal. Eligibility for a temple recommend being currently the trademark of, quote, good Mormons. You must decide how your remodeling plans bear on this fact. You will discover that this decision has far-reaching ramifications. Now, turning to the Rogers, And here there's been a little semantic changes also, because in the paper, the Roger is trying to remodel, to change the church, change the house. The revision has him changing the occupants of the house. Now that's quite a different enterprise. So my remarks are addressed to what it seems to me the more straightforward challenge, and that is to change the house. The Rogers who try to change the house fall into several groups. Those who kick against authority are few, if defined in terms of public defiance and censure, but passive aggressors are fairly numerous, and grumblers and complainers are common. Trying to force changes on others is, as Jeff notes, rarely successful. However, it is my opinion that the tempo and directions of change in today's church can be influenced by active Latter-day Saints who follow this counsel from one of the brethren. And I now quote, "Our Father in heaven has not compelled us to think the same way on every subject or procedure. As we seek to accomplish our life's purposes, we will inevitably have differences with those around us, including some of those we sustain as our leaders. The question is not whether we have such differences, but how we manage them. What the Lord has said on another subject is also true of the management of differences with his leaders. Quote, it must be done in mine own way, in the Doctrine and Covenants. Why aren't these differences, and I'm still quoting, discussed in public debate, or in public debate, the means of resolving differences in the democratic government, is not appropriate in our church government. We are all subjects to the authority of the called and sustained servants of the Lord. They and we are all governed by the direction of the Spirit of the Lord, and that Spirit only functions in an atmosphere of unity. That is why personal differences about church doctrine or procedure need to be worked out privately. There is nothing inappropriate about private communications concerning such differences, provided they are carried on in the spirit of love." That's the end of the quotation. The primary inference from Elder Dallin Oaks' message on criticism is that prayerful interaction will resolve differences in favor of spiritual confirmation of the status quo. But he and the other general authorities understand this historical fact at least as well as you and I. Almost all revelation responds to questions, and the prophets of every age are influenced by environmental inputs as they prayerfully identify problems and possible solutions to submit to the Lord. The two most important revelations since Joseph Smith, on plural marriage and on priesthood eligibility, were asked for by church presidents who responded to a context. Recent changes in temple rituals and ward budgeting came similarly. In today's bureaucratic church, most innovations are shaped by formal and informal reports from missions and stakes, statistical studies, field tests, and committee deliberations. And Jeff has been involved in some of those. In all of these, you and I, our ideas and experiences can provide grist for the mills of the gods. This is one reason why I enjoy being Mormon. Part Frederick, part Mark Mack, part Terry, and part Roger. I like belonging to a church that attracts and holds many people because it helps them to find happiness. I like seeing new needs produce institutional responses, occasionally misconceived, but almost always as good or better than my own ideas on the subject. I like being, like Brother Burton, a missionary to the potential Bobs and Susans in the church who are heading out. And I like playing Roger through provocative questions in classes, participation in Sunstone Symposia, and respectful communication with men whom I sustain as leaders. These changes I would like to see, and I would not be dumbfounded to see them in my lifetime. Replacing the block plan of meetings with a less tightly packed schedule that permits more that permits more informal socializing and brings men and women together in classes that focus on serious issues of gospel living. Addressing a traditional institutional bias by replacing the Priesthood Executive Committee with the Ward Correlation Council as the bishop's primary advisory group, and including mothers in the prayer circles, that name and bless the children of 21st century Mormonism.
All right, thank you, Mr. Paul. We will now accept questions from the audience for the remaining 10 to 15 minutes of the session.
I realize that in using the term fun at one point, I ran the risk, gosh, if I don't have just a great time in all of my dealings with the church, then I ought to go where the fun is. But I don't know of any reason more profound for being a member of a church, or being a Christian for that matter, than that the satisfaction, the richness, the happiness in terms of meaning to life. Good. And that's what I think is meant by that verse from Nephi, that Adam fell, that men might be, and men are, that they might have joy. And I think one of the sad things about the life of many active Mormons is that they get sufficiently involved in keeping the machinery moving that they kind of squeeze the juice out of it, and it isn't fun. If a bishop didn't have the occasional real spiritual high from relating on a person-to-person basis with somebody whose needs are being met through the kind of ministry that he could provide, I would think the calling of a bishop would almost surely drive one out of the church. But it is because of that kind of happiness, the happiness that's associated with worthwhile thing. I don't think a hair shirt is a requirement for spiritual growth and for that matter, exaltation here or hereafter.
If I may, please try to phrase your questions in the form of a question, because we're going to need the speakers to repeat them so that they will be picked up by the tape, and try to keep them at least moderately simple so that they can answer within the limited time we have. Thank you.
Okay, the question was, what if you anticipate that you're not going to have a good reception by sharing your true feelings? And what if you've had that experience? Unfortunately, many have. I met recently a woman who actually was divorced by her husband when she divulged to him the problem. I think I mentioned in the paper that it's a preparation, preparing your people for the truth and for your honesty and being tactful, doing it in a way that they won't reject you. I'm sorry you've had this experience. Many others have too, and it's unfortunate. That's the only thing that I can say about it. In the long term, I don't say that you should go home today and do it, but prepare yourself and your people for it. Otherwise, why be in a religion if it's going to be dishonest? Okay, to put it briefly, the question had to do with how do you handle a temple recommend, and I can give you some indication of the way I've done it, and Brother Paul might have some suggestions too, since he raised it. I have tried to be honest with my priesthood leaders by saying, well, I don't really have that firm, hard testimony. I don't know that this church is true. And in the past, and this has been times when I've been members of bishoprics and on high council and so forth, they've come back to me with, well, Jeff, you have a stronger testimony than you really believe. So, but it has been acceptable. As long as you accept the possibility that it's true, I accept the possibility that the church is true exactly the way the Joseph Smith story says it. It's just that I don't know it. And people seem to accept that idea, given, you know, as long as you don't try to tear anybody else down about it. Brother Paul?
I would agree with that. I think one can be sufficiently honest if one simply confesses that one has doubts about some aspects of the church or its history or its doctrine. The problem with the temple recommend, of course, is that it really doesn't pivot on what you believe at all. It pivots on a certain pattern of deportment, and you have to decide whether that is a pattern of deportment that is satisfactory to you, that you can do in honesty. And if you cannot, then you have self-selected a role on the margin, because as the church exists today, I don't know why anybody would aspire to a church job in any case, but you can't move much beyond the Boy Scout committee if you if you just don't have a temple recommend, and once in a while at least use it.
Are there any other questions? Comments?
The question of whether what we're advocating is just being Mormons because we like being Mormons from a cultural point of view, I think, overlooks the fact that what we belong to, if we belong and are actively involved, is an organization which represents a religious aspiration that has been undergoing more than cosmetic modifications over 160 years. We would not, if we were plunked down into the Church of Kirtland or Nauvoo, we would not recognize where we are. And the church has changed because the aspirations toward God, which it seeks to implement in the lives of people, have required different implementation over time. And the best of us who affirms faith in God is expressing a faith, not a certain knowledge. And as to the founding events, there has been more of a range of interpretation on the part not only of the first generation, but of subsequent generations, and we don't know what took place in the sacred grove. We're entitled, therefore, it seems to me, to hang loose. We have several versions of the prophet's testimony about what happened there, and one of the problems we historians have is that they don't all neatly dovetail together. But the founding myths of great movements often possess that characteristic, and so since we can't do anything about what happened anyway, what's wrong with hanging loose with the unresolved questions and getting in there and doing it, where we can affect the quality of the lives of our family and our community and the people of this world, which so much needs a spiritual uplift.